On February 15, 2008, the Governor's Task Force on Teen Driving met at the Legislative Office Building in Hartford, Connecticut. The following is a recording of that meeting.
Thank you. I'm, as most of you know, Dr. Bob Galvin, and I am the Commissioner of Public Health and co-commissioner of this group, and I will be the presiding officer for today. We have one new person who has joined the board. Diane, would you introduce yourself, as I caught you just swallowing?
Yeah. Good morning. My name is Diane Harnad, and I'm the Director of Prevention at the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And I just want to thank the task force for asking me to join the group.
Okay. And Mr. Hollis, would you introduce yourself, please? I don't think you were here at the last meeting. He was not introduced. Okay.
Yes, Charles Hollis. I work for WZMX 93.7.
And known as Big Man?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Our first order of business today is a presentation by Connecticut Public TV on an upcoming documentary entitled Parents Behind the Wheel. Deputy Commissioner William Ramirez is here representing the Department of Motor Vehicles. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Do we have our CPTV reps? There you are. Okay.
Is that on? Is that better?
Yes.
For the first time in history, we put lipstick cameras in the cars of 10 newly licensed drivers and monitored their driving behavior for a period of 6 months. 8 out of the 10 teens that we monitored got in accidents in those first 6 months. The documentary had gotten a lot of nationwide attention. Jen Boyd, the producer, is here with me today, actually appeared with one of the teens on Good Morning America. She was interviewed on CNN, MSNBC. Also, portions of the documentary were used as part of a Dateline episode with regards to teen driving. Since 2005, hundreds of thousands of DVDs have been ordered nationwide. The Oregon Department of Transportation is using them, independent driving schools, parents, school districts, universities, libraries, insurance department, the Iowa Department of Public Safety, AAA regional offices nationwide, and the California Highway Patrol. Several organizations have used Teens Behind the Wheel as a teaching tool, including the Connecticut Police Chiefs as a teaching aid in educational outreach programs in high school driver education programs. Iowa Public Television ran a statewide classroom connection event on teen driving. Travelers insurance agents throughout the country regularly use the DVD in their offices to educate families of newly licensed teen drivers. Some schools around the country are actually incorporating the documentary into their teen driving safety programs. Teens Behind the Wheel continues to be broadcast on PBS stations across the country. The program is available to the 389 public broadcasting systems. Many stations have come back to us to renew their rights for the next 3 years. This program has a shelf life, and I believe some members of the task force have received copies. If you haven't viewed it, I suggest you do. It's really compelling. According to Nielsen Media Research, from December 2005 through just December 2006, more than 1 million people have viewed this documentary. The numbers will increase as we receive the data from 2007 and 2008. As a result of Teens Behind the Wheel, the producer, Jen Boyd, noticed that when the cameras went on, regardless of whether the teens were in the car or the parents, both driving behaviors were monitored. And she began to notice a correlation between the way the teens drove and how their parents drove. So if they took sharp corners, their kids took sharp corners. If they held their hand on the stick shift with one left hand on the driving wheel, the child tended to emulate the parent's behavior. So she came to us and said, there's something here. And so she wanted to then take a look at really parents behind the wheel, which is the reason why we are here today. And I will let Jen speak to that. One of the things that we are also going to be doing April 15th from 8 to 9 p.m. on Connecticut Public Television, we are going to have a Teens Behind the Wheel town meeting. Some members of this task force were actually asked to be sitting on that panel. Parents Behind the Wheel will air in late May 2008. It'll be the follow-up show. It will explore the parent-child relationship in the car and how parents' behaviors and attitudes towards driving impact those driving behaviors. And now I will introduce Jen Boyd, who is the producer of Teens and Parents Behind the Wheel.
Hi there. I guess there's really, obviously, as Nancy has just said, there's kind of three things going on right now that we're trying to work on. With Parents Behind the Wheel, we've been in production for about 6 months on that. And there's some things that I can talk about and some things I can't because I don't really want the parents and subjects to know some of the things. But what we're mainly looking at is how the role parents can play in driver education. And the challenges that parents face when they're trying to teach their teens how to drive. And those challenges are everything from sitting in the car with them and trying to be a good instructor to how do you deal with graduated licensing. We are exploring how behavior over the course of a lifetime from when a young child is in the car with the parent, how that does influence their behavior later on. There are some studies that have been done on it, but not a whole lot of research. And the feeling is, from a bunch of the national experts that I've been speaking with, is that is an area that will be more heavily researched in the coming years. And we're also using driving simulators to look at the differences between trained and untrained drivers to sort of visually help parents and teens better understand what some of the issues and concerns are when they are newly trained. Let's see. Part of this, then, the whole effort is to also do this teen driving forum. With the two documentaries, Parents Behind the Wheel and Teens Behind the Wheel, we tried to keep it as national as possible. With the town meeting, what we want to do is really get local with it and have lots of people come in and talk about what some of the issues and concerns are from the parents who feel like it's too expensive to now, you know, go to driver's education or to spend that amount of time in the car with their teens because of the new restrictions, to the you know, the benefits of graduated licensing that we've seen across the country. So it'll be a good time to have that conversation as well as to explore what some of the new legislation is that's being proposed. So that's going to air on April 15th, and a lot of you will certainly know about it and be invited to it, and some of you will probably speak on it on the panel. Then the other thing we're doing that's also geared specifically locally is we're hoping to do a retrofit of Teens Behind the Wheel. As some of you may know, one of our lead person in the documentary committed suicide, and it's been a challenge for the family to deal with seeing their child and some of the behavior that was on camera and to have to relive that. So they've said it's certainly okay that it continues to air nationally and it's used as an educational piece, but they would prefer to not have it air locally. So what we are working on is to retrofit it, to still show some of the behavior, but to mask out faces and not include names, and then to use that as an opportunity to look at graduated licensing, specifically in Connecticut, some of the new issues of concern, some of the new laws proposed or by then that have been enacted. And so essentially take out Dan's story and retrofit it to include some of the new updated information, and then hopefully to release it in the fall. So that's where we are. If you have any questions on, you know, specific aspects of it, I'd be happy to answer.
I'm sorry, but I don't know how you picked the teens that you put under surveillance.
Well, what we did is there were a few very kind driving organizations that shared some names with us of families of newly licensed teens. And I just spent 3 months calling families until I found somebody that was willing to do it, and or families that were willing to do it. And there was a sort of a sense of trust that we hopefully weren't going to sensationalize their stories, that it was for educational purposes. And so they were willing to put their trust in us. And I think all of the families, including the Romanos, still feel that it was a worthwhile experience for them. The second time around, we and my co-producer have had to spend months trying to get families, because now the word's out on what, you know, that it, anyway, it's harder. It's harder to get families because you do. It's also harder because you're showing the parents driving in their own car and the teens in their own car. So it's a little harder. But that's how we did it. And we were fortunate enough that there was new technology out there that was just really cutting edge, and they were willing to partner with us on the project.
Oh, I think you did a great job on it. I'm just, when 8 out of 10 of them had crashes, you kind of wondered, did somehow the driving school sense that these were individuals who were less confident than the average kid?
What was fascinating, actually, is that when you go, I asked the parents, you know, did you report this? And one out of those 10 families reported it to their insurance company. So then I think it gets back to the statistics that we already know about for teens. So all the other ones were, you know, they backed up and crashed into their parents' car because they didn't see it in the morning. Or, you know, so it was, or the damage was, you know, they didn't want to report it because they could just fix it, pay for it. So, but I'll tell you, I had one in my car, and you do forget about it. You know, it's just, it's there, you don't, you know, it's small, and so they just went about their business.
That's interesting that 7 out of 8 didn't report damaging a motor vehicle. And almost, that's classic for a kid to, you know, backs out of the driveway and runs over somebody's bicycle, hopefully not with a person on it, or dad's car, they didn't notice.
Well, two of those kids did that,
Yeah, somehow didn't notice, you know, an SUV behind them, et cetera. How did you select the simulator?
Oh, well, actually it was proximity. You know, some of this is always a budget factor, but there's a great program in at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and so they have a big sort of studio with driving simulators in that, and they've been doing some research on trained and untrained drivers for quite a while. So in this case, what we're doing is looking at we sit them in this driving simulator, and we monitor their retina, and it determine if they we monitor where they're looking at any given point. So a trained driver will see the bus, even though it's an animated bus, and a crosswalk, and they'll know to look around the bus and keep driving. But an untrained driver, as we clearly saw, just keeps driving straight and never even bothers to stop or slow down to make sure that there isn't somebody there. So that kind of stuff was very interesting. And then we took them out onto the street, put this headgear on, again monitoring their retina, and having a camera record, and then a computer program marries the two images together, so you see crosshairs of where the retina is looking and married together with the images of their surroundings, their true surroundings on a road in Amherst. And then you can see what the behavior is like, and we took parents and teens and compared them.
That's very interesting. And some of my aviation training, I've flown helicopter flight simulators flown into some conditions that I couldn't get out of, and I crashed the module on some occasions,
really?
Because it's built for very difficult conditions and icing and things like that.
Right.
And you crash them. A little voice comes in your ear and says you just crashed, which is unpleasant. But I'm very interested in that type of thing. Thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
Any other questions?
I have two questions, and if I can't speak, I hope my assistant will help me. Who's funding the project?
Travelers has funded all our driving projects thus far. And
We have funding for Parents Behind the Wheel from the CarMax Foundation and the Department of Insurance.
In addition.
Okay. Which version of Behind the Wheel is being distributed to the Connecticut Principals Association and will be given out to the high school principals?
That is, the decision was made not to distribute. I've been working with Bill Seymour because of the sensitivities of the Romanos family it was our thought, and Jen can attest to it, because Channel 8 had called her last week, wanted to use the footage from the Romanos family, because if you've seen the documentary, I think you'll understand why. So we decided not to distribute it.
Until we do the retrofit, and then hopefully. Yeah.
I appreciate that, because many of the high schools have their own TV studios, and goes out distribution to local networks.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Is this a proprietary video or not? Is it essentially public domain or not?
Well, you can speak to it. Has the copyright, but anybody can purchase copies.
We get releases from all the students and parents and families. We have every right to air the show locally, but we choose not to.
Any further questions? If not, thank you very much. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I'm at Travers. I just wanted to just state that we've been funding this, and I've seen the video a couple times, and I'm in the research area of Travers, and it's, you know, we look at numbers all day long, and the video just brings all the numbers, all the statistics right out in the open. I mean, you see the evidence of the distractions, all kinds of things going on, and you mentioned that the video is compelling, and I can't disagree more. I can't agree more. It is very compelling.
Thank you.
I have a 17-year-old daughter who's going through driver's ed, and I have showed her this documentary, and it scared the hell out of her. So it was impactful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will now move on to item number 3, some committee updates, training and education. Training and education going once.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, we will do our report now. My apologies. The Subcommittee on Training and Education continues to make, we think, good progress. In our last meeting held on Monday, we reviewed aspects of the Connecticut approach to driver's education with the assistance of Task Force member Mario Damiata, who is sitting next to me, and we thank him very much. We looked at the Massachusetts programs that address teen drivers who commit certain moving violations. We were also introduced to the layers of complexity surrounding Connecticut's laws on the subject of infractions and violations, and as a non-attorney, I wouldn't pretend to know it yet. With an eye toward providing greater uniformity of training within the state, we are exploring the following. The issue of curricula for teens, whether they are taught professionally or at home, options that exist for training requirements for 18 and 19-year-olds who are seeking their first license, the possible application of driving simulators for training, the need for a brief parental orientation and education session, which Massachusetts has adopted, programs for teens who are ticketed, and for those who go to secondary or commercial training programs, the issue of instructor qualification and performance. Finally, in the area of training, we are looking at the DMV testing procedures, since many teens seeking a license learn with these test standards in mind. Information that is necessary for safe driving is often ignored if it seems unlikely that its retention will be required in order to pass the test. Since additional training for teen violators is of some concern to us, and with acknowledgement of the need to work with our subcommittee on laws, we are also exploring the ways in which the creation of a junior operator class for statutes might simplify the process. And we are researching the current handling of teen violators. We will be finished before the deadline for submissions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Yes, ma'am.
I just have one more comment that I just met with one of the other subcommittee chairs. We're finding that we're crossing over on a lot of our thought processes and recommendations. And so for the subcommittee chairs, we would request to have a separate meeting to help make sure that we don't cross over our paths and time frames as well. There's a time deadline, and it's going to take all we have to get what we need to get done. So we're requesting a separate meeting just for the chairs.
Thank you, and you may be able to streamline that process, or at least, you know, get the round pegs and the round holes, and so that you're not duplicating the effort of a lot of very skilled people who have demands on their time. Are there any other questions? Okay. Public and parental awareness.
Rosemary Cipriano, representing the Connecticut Principals Association. And I co-chair with Yvette Bellows from Latino Community Service, and she'll do the presentation.
Great. Do you have that one page? Great. Our subcommittee has met, and of the seven recommendations that were on the table, we have seemed to be still working on them. However, we're working on refining the language that's included in the recommendations. And actually, we're meeting today after this meeting to finalize that language. But we seem to be confident that we're on track for the reporting requirements, and look forward to meeting with Jillian and the other subcommittee chairs to streamline our processes as well.
Could you just briefly go over the seven recommendations?
Absolutely. We have passed, the ones that we have passed are to provide parents and guardians to be notified of moving violations by drivers under the age of 18. The second recommendation that was passed tentatively with language, we're going to be working on this language, is to mandate an education session for parents and guardians of 16 to 17-year-olds learner permit holders. Again, that language is going to be revised, but it generally sounded with our discussions that it should be something that would be we would include in our recommendations. Number five, again, another one that we tentatively agreed on, is to create a parent education program on available technology to track teen drivers, and it's including broad recommendations, but not vendor recommendations. So we were clear on just an informational session on what's out there that may help parents with their teens. And numbers, the other one, is to institute programs at high school parking lots exits to check for compliance with passenger restrictions and seatbelt requirements. Again, the language is going to be worked on to include a more of an encouragement to do this with local partnership with local high schools and their local police departments. So it's more of an encouragement recommendation than a mandate. And that's pretty much it.
Thank you, Yvette. Are there any questions? If not, we'll move on to laws.
Sorry, Doctor. Just let me. Any recommendations regarding a general public awareness campaign or anything to update the DMV website?
We're actually going to be meeting. We started that process in looking at a statewide campaign to include those elements, but we are still in the creative process. But that was our method of delivery for the not only what our committee includes, but also what the entire task force. So that we are working on that idea.
Any further questions of Ms. Bell? If not, we'll move on to laws, policies, and regulations.
Thank you, Commissioner. Before I talk about the Law and Policy Subcommittee, I do want to say what I think every member of the task force has thought during the past few weeks, and we want to say an interim thank you to Bill Seymour. His work in the flow of keeping the flow of information going on this task force has been nothing short of amazing. We think he may have been cloned along the way because no single person could stay up that late. Is that right, Bill? But anyway, I just want to say he's doing a great job, and we're all benefiting from it. This subcommittee had actually deferred its meeting, first main meeting, until today, with the hope that we would have the governor's bills taking our short-term recommendations to look at. My understanding is the bill did not come out with an HB number until yesterday, so we did not have that to look at, but we will obviously do that before the Transportation Committee meets next Wednesday. But we did meet this morning, and I'll try to summarize what we talked about this morning. The first item was revisiting the short-term recommendation that siblings of the teen driver not be allowed in the vehicle during the learner's permit stage. And the reason we revisited this is since we did our short-term recommendations, we received a number of emails making what was actually a valid point, which is if I'm a single parent or even a two-parent household where there are younger children in the family, in order to do the training on the road, I can't always hire a babysitter. And it, if you want me to do more hours especially, I need to have my other kids in the car. Valid concern, particularly one of those socioeconomic concerns that we've talked about in this task force. The countervailing views were that a learner's permit driver, by definition, is the least experienced category of drivers. If it's a driving lesson, it should be a driving lesson that's focused on instruction and not interrupted or distracted by siblings. And essentially, I think where we came down is that this is a matter of safety that trumps the real issue of babysitters or dealing with other siblings. But we just felt that to leave the recommendation where it is. But we ultimately decided to defer the issue. We'll take it up one more time at our next meeting. Mr. Preusser is going to see if he can find accident data on the learner's permit stage. I suppose if we were told that the learner's permit stage is unquestionably a very safe stage, maybe we'll rethink it. But so ultimately we deferred it, but I think we're leaning towards not changing that recommendation. Second thing we discussed today was raising the beginning age for the learner's permit. And there we did reach a consensus to leave it as is, that is 16 years of age. The issue there is that obviously driver training for teens is a 12, 18-month process, and if we start the learner's permit age at 16 and a half or 17, then that all-important period of supervised training will come when a good number of teens have left the household for college, that would be an unintended consequence of changing the age. So leave the age where it is. However, we are prepared as one of our long-term recommendations to say, and this is consistent with raising the hours of instruction from 20 to 50, that the learner's permit stage should be increased. It's currently 4 months with driver's ed. That should be increased to 6 months. And it's 6 months without driver's ed. That should be increased to 8 months. That is also a recommendation that's supported by the Teen Safe Driving Partnership. So we will be including that in our recommendation. Okay, third item we discussed today is windshield or other vehicle identification stickers. This particular item came out of a discussion that was had yesterday with a number of local police chiefs, whose message to a couple of the task force members and Commissioner Ward was, we can maximize our enforcement capability if we have the ability to identify from the outside a vehicle that is being driven by a teen or someone who's subject to the GDL requirements. Obviously a very valid concern. On the other hand, as task force members all know, we've received a lot of emails about issues of teens, particularly parents of teenage girls, being targeted by other drivers, you know, insurance fraud, accident fraud, pedophiles, any number of issues. So there are real issues on the other side of the coin. We were reminded that the survey that Dave Preusser's group took indicated a low level of public support for a sticker system, and in fact some real opposition to it. Mario Damiata and Angie Byrne said that the stickers have not proven effective in changing teenage drivers. So I think where we ended up is that a sticker that is identifiable from the outside of the vehicle at this point raises too many issues that would prevent us from making it part of our recommendation. The last thing that we got through today is further coordination between the court system and the Department of Motor Vehicles in terms of reporting of convictions. This is obviously a complex issue. We were joined by Fran Carino from the Chief State's Attorney's Office, who's in charge of the juvenile division, pointed out that an additional complication in this is that in 2010 in Connecticut, 16 and 17-year-olds will now be classified as juveniles. And many matters, justice matters involving them, will now go to juvenile court with an additional layer of confidentiality and reporting, so that we're going to have to look carefully to make sure that, among other things, this matrix of suspension penalties is not, you know, undermined or inconsistent with that change in the law. I mentioned to the subcommittee that I have been making efforts to get in touch with the with Judge Quinn, the Chief Court Administrator, and with the State's Attorney's Office to review these issues with them, because obviously we're going to need to raise awareness among the judges and the prosecutors about this issue of treating teen drivers as a class for which we should have either zero tolerance or less tolerance, issues of continuance of court dates and things like that. So that will be part of our long-term recommendations, is trying to improve that. We did not get to today to parent-initiated suspensions and revocations, which has also been looked at by Rosemary and Yvette's subcommittee, or parent moving violation notification procedures, but we will take that up at our next meeting. Sorry for the long report, Mr. Chairman. So.
Thank you. It was very comprehensive, and I did not find it long. In regards to some of the issues that you folks have been discussing, Deputy Commissioner Ramirez has some update on the curfew hours and where we sit with those proposals.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner. We've been informed this morning from the governor's office that the governor intends to raise the curfew time to 11 o'clock instead of 10 o'clock, which was the time that was submitted by the committee. And the Transportation Committee has a public hearing next week, February 20th, on Wednesday at 11 o'clock in the morning. They're going to be raising HB number 5043, which is the act concerning teen drivers.
Mr. Ramirez reminds me of one other thing I need to bring up. The matrix of suspensions and penalties that we adopted, I guess, contains an oversight or an omission of a relevant statute. The speeding statutes are, our matrix says 14-219. It should also include 14-218 little a. In other words, the speeding statutes are contained in two statutes, not one. I think that was clearly our intent to cover that statute, but I just wanted to make a point on the record that we'll have to make sure that the governor's bills address both statutes in dealing with the speeding suspensions. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Just a question on the sticker situation. I know there's general opposition to this now. And did they consider something like a handicapped parking thing that could be applied when the 16 and 17-year-olds are in this car, instead of affixing a sticker that's on there totally all the time? Did that ever come up in the discussion? I'm just throwing this up for discussion here right now, Counselor.
Senator, yes. Particularly, Lieutenant Colonel Terenzi brought to our attention the idea of a medallion that hangs from the rearview mirror. One of the pushback points was you can't hang anything from your rearview mirror. That's illegal, but
well, there's a lot of illegals going on with the handicap parking and parking permits and anything else, but maybe we could make it legal in a particular case in the statute if that has to be done.
When we talked to the police chiefs yesterday, they made what I heard was two points. They would love to be able to identify the vehicle from the outside, because that helps them stop the vehicle. Second is, when they make the stop and they look into the car, is identifying that the driver is subject to the GDL requirements. So medallion, something from the rearview mirror, is one way to do that. Another one is, this was brought up by DMV staff, you know, we now issue a vertical license under 21 and a horizontal license if you're over 21, which I gather is part of the, you know, the liquor laws. But we could, for example, when the 17-year-old gets the provisional license, we could state right on the license, subject to GDL until, and put the person's 18th birthday. So the officer with the stop has an easier way to identify that this is someone subject to the GDL. Another thing that came up yesterday was put the GDL restrictions right on the back of the license. The medallion issue is a sort of partial answer. There is the issue of hanging it from the rearview mirror. It doesn't address the police chief's issue about being able to identify the vehicles from the outside.
Let me just ask, you received many emails and letters, you say, in correspondence resisting or objecting to the vehicle being identified. Can you share some of the reasons with us?
Sure, and other subcommittee members can chime in. We heard about the experience in Florida where they identified rental vehicles through the license plate and they were being targeted on the highways for, I guess, intentional accidents, yeah, you would call them. Second is we heard from parents of teenage girls who said, I do not want my teenage girl driving alone be identified as a teen who was in the car alone, that predators or I guess pedophiles might be drawn to such. Jim McPherson from AAA shared with us some experience where even just the identification of student drivers will cause some people to intentionally obstruct the path of the vehicle. So how frequent these are, I don't know, and I suppose it would be very difficult to determine, but we got enough emails on this subject, and I guess Dave Preusser's research concerned that confirmed that there's enough pushback from the public that I don't think the subcommittee was ready to go ahead and certainly recommend an external sticker. And then there's practical issues, you know, stickers fall off and things like that.
Thank you. I'd just like to let everybody know we've been joined by the Transportation House Chairman Anthony Guerrero from Rock Hill and the ranking Republican member of the House Committee, David Scrivener. Both have been very active in years past when I served on that committee in teenage driving and the graduate license process. So welcome. Maybe you get some good ideas from us here this morning, gentlemen, and bring them back to your committee. Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Are there any further comments? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out some technology that I don't know if your committee was aware of, and it's definitely new, but there's license plate recognition technology that's available, and it's something that would sit on the top of the police car, and it's able to scan license plates and match them up against a database. And it's very effective where it's been used. I've read about it in Albany to catch a stolen vehicle. it recognizes that registration sticker is a stolen vehicle, and it beeps to the officer in the car. It's a new technology. It's maybe less efficient in this use of trying to identify a teen driving a vehicle. You're not trying to You want it to beep every time a teen drives by, but it's something to think about for the future. That if there's something that's tagged in DMV that this car, one of the drivers is a teen driver, it may be another way without some of the risks of a sticker.
Yeah, I think what you're saying is there a way to affix an identifier to the vehicle, or perhaps even to the individual's driver's permit, that would allow the sworn officers and police only to identify the vehicle and
correct
the general public. So there may be some good technology. You could create something that would expire in a year or cease to give a signal in a year. That's a very interesting observation. Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
Any further comments or questions?
There was an Australian model that was forwarded to us task force members. Apparently in Australia, when there's a newly licensed driver or a teen driver in the family, there's a different license plate issued for that vehicle for a period of time, and it's like L1 and L2, depending on how long that driver has been licensed. So I guess that the family cars all have their license plates changed for a period of time. Seems like it could be an idea that could work rather than a sticker. But on this issue of having teen girls targeted because there's a sticker, I think it's very easy for pedophiles, people targeting teenage girls, to look through the glass and see that there's a teenage girl in that car by herself. I don't see that having a sticker identifying this driver as a newly licensed driver is going to increase targeting of pedophiles. This is my personal opinion.
Yes, ma'am.
I disagree, because you have the younger, it's a younger girl, and you're separating them from any of the young women that we would have at the colleges, I mean, at the high school level. Whether it's urban or suburban schools, we're constantly plagued by individuals that have misintent to any actions towards, whether it's the young boys or the young women. So I don't distinguish between the boys and the girls, but I think that you're putting them in jeopardy by having any sign on the vehicles.
Well, I think that what we're trying to do is identify the vehicle to law enforcement and not to anybody else. So if we do a prefix or suffix or on the license plates or something that's inside the car, then we open that up for so that anybody can identify a new driver for whatever reasons they may have, whereas we were looking for law enforcement individuals to be able to identify the vehicle for purposes of scrutiny or violations. And I think whatever we do, if we do anything, it should be something that's available only to sworn officers and not to the general public. Any further questions? If not, we'll move on to item 3D, public health, multicultural health.
Hi. The Public Health and Multicultural Health Committee met for the first time this week. Our goal is to complement the work of the other subcommittees, and in an effort not to duplicate what other committees were doing, we came up with a preliminary goal, which is to increase teen driver safety by providing recommendations on the collection and analysis of data to assess the extent of the problem that teen driving poses in Connecticut and whether current policies and strategies adequately address these problems. We have membership from the Department of Public Health, Mental Health and Addiction Services, the Chief of Police, Criminal Justice, Chief State's Attorney's Office, National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, medical personnel, and we're hoping meet the media. Prior to our meeting, one of our first steps was to review literature on teen driving and risk behaviors, including brain development, because that seemed to be bubbling up a lot at the last meeting. And we also looked at epidemiological data from the Department of Transportation and the 2005 Connecticut student survey on health in the schools. And we also looked at the Task Force Adult and Parent Survey. And while we don't have a definitive approach, what we are proposing at this point in time, it's preliminary, is using what we're calling a logic model to increase teen driver safety. And what we would like to do is to assess and track over time the extent of the problem, looking at indicators such as injury accidents, fatal accidents, DUIs, DUI crashes, crashes with passengers. And we're also looking at risk factors related to lack of experience, seatbelt use, nighttime driving, teen passengers, gender, alcohol, brain development, driver distractions, vehicle safety, parental modeling. We also would like to look at policies, programs, and practices that are currently in place, such as clicker or ticket programs, laws and programs that decrease underage drinking, media campaigns, and especially law enforcement around changes in the graduated driving license statute, if that happens, including increasing educating law enforcement and parents on the new laws. We also talked about an interesting model program that's happening in Massachusetts called Operation Every Teen Counts, where there are actual checkpoints on driver safety indicators on school grounds. And Chief Rio can talk about that a little bit. Just some preliminary discussions. And our goal really is to track outcomes over time to see whether or not there is a decrease in injury accidents, a decrease in fatal accidents, decrease in DUIs or DUI crashes, decrease in nighttime crashes, decrease in crashes with passengers.
So we're really looking at a public health approach to this, looking at epidemiological data. That was one approach. We also talked about special populations and issues such as language and language barriers. We learned that there's a large population in Connecticut that does not speak English, and we want to make sure that there are culturally relevant materials, including parent manuals that are in Spanish that are available so that parents can understand the new laws. And we talked about assessing the hardships or the impact of changes in the graduated driver's licensing on youth and their families. And Chief Rio also has some things to add.
Yes, I'm the co-chair of that committee, and I have no experience in public health, but I would like to make a few comments as part of that. To complement what Diane was saying, we obtained a focus group report from Angie from NHTSA that talks about teen unsafe driving behaviors, which we're currently reviewing. And we thought that maybe taking off on that, we could get some input prior to the next public hearing at the Career High School in New Haven to possibly get some input on the GDL issue from teens and parents in a diverse environment to see if there are any issues that we're not recognizing at this time. And I wanted to comment, too, on some of the things regarding the police chief's meeting yesterday. Commissioner Ward was kind enough to ask for our direct input, and we had six chiefs or representatives present at the meeting, along with a representative from the state police, and spoke about some of the proposals, long and the short-term goals. And the chiefs overwhelmingly support the efforts that are being proposed at this time. They support the matrix for the penalties. But the big concern among our group, law enforcement, is the ability to enforce any proposals that come forward. You know, we feel that while they are legitimate and appropriate, that there will be pressure on us to make sure that we support it. And without any tools, it's going to be very difficult. I know that there was an overwhelming feeling that some type of recognition, such as a sticker or maybe something more sophisticated, like the devices that can to get information from Motor Vehicle Department, were necessary for us to be proactive on this. Short of that, our hands are still tied, just like many other laws. We feel that we can participate in checkpoints at schools. Those of us that have the resources in school resource officers or youth officers, many other departments are strapped financially. And so we had asked DOT and NHTSA if they would consider some grant opportunities to enable us to perform those. But as law enforcement, and I know I spoke to Lieutenant Colonel Terenzi a little bit about this, we agree to disagree a little bit about the risk to youth from these identifiers. There are many people out there that are much more vulnerable that have identifiers right now, including handicapped, and they do drive around with them on their rear mirror. I just saw one yesterday. They are out there. I believe they're more vulnerable than a youth. There's people with Purple Heart license plates, veterans, elderly people that are our targets also. And I think that all it takes is, as Ms. Cruz said, is for someone to look in the window and they're going to identify their target. They're not going to utilize these markers. But I understand the issues and the problems. I understand the survey has shown that a majority of people are concerned about that. I just wish that would be considered. It will help us because we want to do the right thing and support this legislation. And I'm glad that 14218A was added. That was a concern among us. And I'm glad that the curfew has been adjusted, too. I think that's going to be that's a reasonable request. So, and I think an education campaign is necessary on this. We use some parallels to the Click It or Ticket campaign, which increased seatbelt usage significantly. And we also looked at the You Drink, You Drive, You Lose campaign, national campaign, which has also brought DUI awareness. I think if we do the same thing with this legislation, that we will achieve a measure of success that we can't get if we don't. So thank you.
Thank you, Chief. And I'm would like to, the committee to bear in mind that the parts of this program are selecting drive people who can and should drive, training them and in an appropriate fashion, but the chief and the colonel see the failures or impending failures, and we need to listen to them. They're not looking at this from the most pleasant point of view. They're looking at it from a regulation and enforcement point of view, and their early intervention with someone may be the difference between that individual surviving as an adequate driver or not surviving, and we need to equip our law enforcement individuals with the appropriate tools to do what they know best to do, having both these gentlemen have spent a whole career in law enforcement, and I'm sure that between the colonel and the chief, they've stopped many people and maybe saved lives by admonishing them or fining them or removing them from the road for a period of time. We need to listen very carefully and to equip them with the type of tools they need to identify and to have appropriate penalties. If the chief's force out in Farmington stops people and there's no real significant enforcement, then it's not only a waste of his time, but it's a waste of our opportunity to interdict someone before they turn into a statistic. And I'm sure that both the colonel and the chief have pulled more than one person out of a vehicle. So have I as a medical examiner, but that's the ultimate failure. It's our failure. It's public health failure. It's an unintentional injury failure. And we all fail when something like that happens. But thank you, Chief. Are there any other comments or questions?
I just would say, you know, we're very supportive of the concerns of the police chiefs and totally respect their need to have tools. Again, if Connecticut does go down this road, it is venturing into uncharted waters. No other GDL state uses ID stickers. NHTSA has not evaluated any of this. We feel there's enough risky behavior taking place on the roadways that there's plenty of ways to identify people. But we still respect the concerns and are willing to do everything we can to help make it doable in Connecticut.
Are there any further comments or questions? If not, I will advise all subcommittees that their final reports are due 28 March and will be distributed to the task force for review prior to the 4 April meeting. I will public forums, I canceled the meeting on Wednesday night in New Haven because of what I thought were adverse driving conditions and the fact that it would disadvantage some people who didn't feel that they could drive to the meeting, and we certainly didn't want to create a situation where there was a motor vehicle mishap on the way to this type of meeting. Subsequent dates, 25 February at Stonington High School, in Stonington. This is co-sponsored by the Day of New London, the area newspaper. 27 February, New Haven at the Hill Regional Career High School, co-sponsored with that high school. Detailed information and maps will be available. And a tentative date of 10 March in Danbury at the Danbury High School, which is co-sponsored by that institution. Meeting schedule for this task force, 14 March for subcommittee updates, the Traveler's Office in Windsor, 4 April Legislative Office Building for discussion of subcommittee final reports, and in early May, the last meeting of this distinguished task force with a final vote on recommendations. We do have some time for other business and for comments from members of the committee or from individuals in the audience if you'd like to make such comments. If there are some, please raise your hand, identify yourself, and if you're in the audience or if there are any of the board members, group members, who would. John Berger?
I just had some technology issue. I don't know if there's anybody out there developing it, but given the GPS systems that are becoming available on almost every automobile today, and given the black box that resides already as a data gathering tool within the link to the automobile's PCM program control module,
it would be possible for a parent, just like on their computers and laptops at home, via security codes to, what I would call, code into the automobile, where it can go, how fast it can go, what G-forces it can tolerate around the corner and have limitations on all that sort of stuff. And I don't know if that's a good idea or a bad idea, but I do know that the technology exists to be able to implement it.
Thank you, John. That's an excellent comment. We in the public health VISTA see people all over the state, and we're always concerned about the ability for people of moderate means to pay into those kind of systems, particularly, it might be a little easier for some suburbanites to do that, a little harder for people who live in the major cities of Connecticut to expend more cash, particularly if the training hours get extended. But that's a very good comment. Are there any further comments? Yes, sir.
Two things I wanted to raise. This may have been mentioned before, but I just want to make sure everybody knows that the Transportation Committee is going to take up the governor's bill that contains our short-term recommendations at a public hearing next Wednesday at 11 o'clock. And I believe the staff is working on possibly some members of the task force being able to testify during as part of the public official presentation. But obviously, everything we've been working on is now coming to a head next Wednesday. So as I think as many people as can be there, hopefully will do so. Second, different point, I want to honor a promise I made to Jim McPherson to raise an issue. We've heard a lot about teens driving what are called high-performance vehicles, mega horsepower, very large SUVs, vehicles that are very different than what they've been trained on. And I just want to throw out this issue. I don't have a good... as a member of the Law and Policy Subcommittee, I don't have a good answer as to how we could regulate that, because if there's one family car and it happens to be a so-called high-performance vehicle, we want the teens to be trained, and I don't know that parents are going to go out and buy another car or rent another car just for those training purposes. On the other hand, it is an issue that has obviously figured in several of the more recent fatalities in Connecticut. So, and also, I didn't hear it in any of the subcommittee reports, so maybe it needs to go to one of the subcommittees particularly, but it's an issue I did not want to gloss over or get lost.
Thank you, and I think there's perhaps a way of at least looking at this. If we're going to use driving simulation, perhaps we need something that addresses vehicles that are very powerful, that are very fast, that are designed to accelerate very rapidly, and they're certainly not like the most of us probably learn how to drive on if it was a second car, was some old clunker that wouldn't get out of its own way, or a Jeep or something like that. And now we have people driving BMWs and cars that were designed for perhaps for older individuals, more mature individuals, and maybe we need a subset of our training. If you're going to drive something that's an inherently risky vehicle, by whatever definition we want to put into it, assign to it, that perhaps we need to create a better training vehicle. And I know one of the accidents that we've all considered was a youngster driving a high-performance vehicle and resulted in four deaths, including someone who was not in the vehicle, was just doing his thing. Any further questions, comments? Yes, ma'am. Well, that's certainly an interesting prospect. Of course, it's illegal to drink below the age or possess alcohol below age 21. and below age 18, I suppose you can't say it's more illegal, but it's also an offense to do that. And I'm not sure where a monitoring system would fit in, with the exception of someone who already had a conviction or an infraction which involved alcohol use. I'm not sure enough about the law that if you have it in the car with you, is that not an offense because you're not supposed to possess alcohol under age 21? But I would think there would be some room for a discussion about if you get stopped, even and you have even though you have a .05 or some fairly negligible amount of alcohol, you're not supposed to have any. And I think perhaps we should consider about if you're stopped and you have alcohol and testable alcohol in your system, then maybe you need to be monitored.
I think in this age group, it has a tremendous deterrent value to have alcohol in the system, wearing a bracelet, in terms of peer pressure and drinking and the imposition of actually having to wear the bracelet, and the fact that it's promoting abstinence, what we have to do with our underage drinkers.
I think that's a valid consideration. Thank you. Colonel, did you have anything you wanted to add to that? Thank you. Any other comments? Questions? If not, we will...
I just want to make a comment about the discussion about high-performance vehicles. And it's... I'm not sure what to do about that either, but as an insurance company, we look at that as, we recognize the risk. It's, we have, usually we charge more when somebody owns a high-performance vehicle anyway, and if we recognize that there's a young driver driving that high-performance vehicle, we think that ought to be a pretty exorbitant premium on your insurance policy. That's not necessarily a solution to the problem, and it gets into ability to pay. I think that it could be part of the solution, but I'd be curious as to the task force members what their perspective on that is. I mean, typically people with kids pay a lot more on their insurance anyway, and to the extent that we can help save lives, we can help people save premium as well. Just wondering if other people look at it the same way.
I'm in agreement with that. I think that perhaps if you can own a $60,000 or $70,000 high-performance vehicle and you get another grand every 6 months tacked onto your insurance so your 17-year-old can drive it, maybe that's affordable to people who can buy $70,000 or $190,000 vehicles. Yeah. I am concerned about things this is not a one-size-fits-all problem. And so there are certain things that are germane to very well-to-do people, perhaps, I think additional training, but perhaps some additional parent contact. You really want your kid driving around a $75,000 high-performance vehicle when he's probably got less than 100 hours of total driving time. If you're doing pilot training, you sure wouldn't turn somebody loose on a G3 Gulfstream 3 with a couple of hundred hours. I mean, you don't even think about that until they got 1,000 hours in less complicated aircraft. Usually somebody else's if you own the G3, so...
Yep.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
In light of the time, I'm just going to wander very briefly into an area which may be outside the envelope here. I'm not sure the committee, this task force, would want to get into it. It's an area that would be fraught with legal problems, but it's in connection with these high-performance vehicles. When I turn on my television, which is not that often, I am constantly confronted with ads of zoom, 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 cars doing 360s into parking lots, speeding across deserts at 100 miles an hour. Now, we regulate, as a society, tobacco, alcohol ads. We put warnings on cigarettes, etc. And I find it particularly disturbing that those kinds of ads are regularly viewed by our young people. It encourages them not only to drive high-performance vehicles, but to drive them in a way which, in my opinion, is totally irresponsible. And I personally believe that our motor vehicle companies, these advertisers, are irresponsible in promoting these ads. I don't know whether this has been considered. I suspect not. I don't know whether you want to wander into that kind of a discussion, either here or in the subcommittee level. And I'm not even sure, well, I am sure that it would present all kinds of legal problems. But it's one area that has never been discussed here that I find particularly disturbing, and I just throw that out there for that anybody shares my views.
Thank you, Judge, and I think you and I have probably seen the same ad that shows up a vehicle skidding into a parking space, a vehicle that's northbound and skids into a parking space in the southbound side of the highway. And that's not a very good example.
Professional driver closed course.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But thank you for your comments, sir. Any further comments? Yes, sir.
If I might very briefly point out that as one who is involved on a somewhat daily basis with teenage driving students, that in fact the influence of all sorts of entertainment that goes well beyond advertisements very much comes to bear in terms of what they hope to replicate once they get their license. And it has actually become in some classes such a topic of conversation that I've actually spent time, not much, but some time, pointing out what goes into producing one of these television commercials or a chase scene in a Hollywood movie. And the fact that producers who have been involved in this tell me that it can take an entire day to film less than 1 minute. And for teens to think that they can go out and replicate these feats, and many of them do, for teens to think that this is possible, I think, is a tragic misunderstanding of what actually does occur. And we combine that with the fact that, indeed, one of the issues when I suggested the performance car issue be considered, one of the factors is that the price of performance is actually coming down. And if we look at the cost of some of the vehicles that were involved in some of the most recent collisions that have garnered the state's attention and that had truly tragic consequences, we will find that these were, in fact, affordable motor vehicles that had very low weight-to-horsepower ratios and that were put in the hands of individuals who, in my opinion, and I think we can justify that opinion based on the consequences and the events, were inadequately trained and did not have the background to control it. And when we combine what we've heard about the teenage brain and the fact that it is slow in developing in terms of judgment and restraint, and then we put these teenagers into vehicles that have 300-plus horsepower, I think inevitably there will be that temptation for which there may not be enough judgment or restraint to resist. There will be that temptation to see exactly what the vehicle can do. And one way to avoid that is simply to say that people who do not have the experience that is deemed to be necessary to control this kind of vehicle shouldn't drive one.
I need to add something to that statement. As someone who works with teenagers every single day, I can tell you that a favorite topic of conversation among the teenage boys in the classroom before class, after class, and during break is the type of car they're going to drive, how powerful it's going to be, how fast it's going to go, the kinds of tricks they're going to do with it. The girls want something cute to drive. The boys want something powerful. And it doesn't even have to be an expensive car. They buy older cars and they modify them. A lot of these boys have the ability to do that. And perhaps what we need to look at is passing some form of legislation limiting the amount of horsepower that we're going to allow teens to have under the hood. And so we're not talking so much about what they borrow from mom and dad. We're talking about what these kids are driving, their own vehicles. Some of them are bought by mom and dad, and we probably can't legislate common sense for parents, but we can tell them, well, if you're going to go out and buy your child a vehicle, it can't have more than X amount of horsepower. Something for consideration.
Thank you. And I think, as Judge Dabrowski brings up, we're now getting into issues that are very germane, but they're cultural issues. You know, we're a culture where people like to have shiny cars go very fast and with a lot of horsepower and go from, you know, even though you're going to drive it from East Hartford to Hartford, they get from 0 to 60 in 3.98 seconds. And that's kind of inculcated into our culture, and it's very interesting to bring out the difference between the sexes, that the girls want something that looks cute, the guys want something that's macho. And so there was a lot of, in discussing this problem, that there's a lot of things other than just curfews and additional training. There's a lot of our culture which encourages some behaviors which are very deleterious to part of our population that doesn't have the sophistication to deal with them. There are other cultures and where people don't do these kinds of things, that it's not a primary goal to have a 300 horsepower vehicle that's faster than the next guy's, but that's not quite our culture. But thank you very much. Any further questions? Yes, sir.
Dr. Galvin, I was just going to follow up with one comment related to that. I think I agree with everything that's been said in this aspect of the discussion and agree with it by and large. You need only look to tobacco to see how Joe Camel advertising and actors smoking in movies impacts the behavior that we see in teenagers. But what I think is critically important is we need to keep our eye on the ball, and what do we know has proven to work to help reduce teenage car crashes and teenage deaths. And graduated driver's licensing systems have been proven to do that, in particular as we've already reiterated, the nighttime driving restriction, reducing passengers, and prolonging the learner's permit phase. And that's the one evidence-based thing that I can bring to the table from a public health perspective that we really have to focus on, because we know that that works.
And I think what you're saying is we got to fix what we can fix, and then we have to look at other issues that got us to the point where there was something to fix. And when you talk about advertising, I always marvel at some of these movies. There's an old movie called What Price Glory and some other ones where the wounded hero is gasping his last words, and it's next to his last words, can I have a cigarette? Which is probably, you know, when you have acute blood loss and you've been gunshot two or three times, the last thing in the world you want is to try to puff a cigarette while you're trying to get a few more words out. But that becomes inculcated to our culture. And you know the old thing about the man and the woman who they light up cigarettes. He lights two cigarettes up and gives one to her. But that's getting out of our culture, and we need to do some things about, you know, driving really, you know, at 100 miles an hour is not cool. But that's a real long-range cultural thing. But thank you for your observations. Any further questions, yes, ma'am.
I think that there's an awareness issue here, and I believe maybe the Parental and Public Awareness Subcommittee may be able to do something in terms of addressing this in its statewide media campaign.
I think that's all. I think, you know, the sharp end of the spear is getting some legislative efforts forward, which work towards things we know work and work in other states, and better training, and listening to law enforcement and making sure that those who fail the training or don't take the training to heart are reinstructed or given another opportunity before they create a tragedy. So it's This is a big task and a big cultural task, and I thank you for all your input. And if there are no further comments, I will hold us as adjourned. Thank you.